In his new book, Return to Sender, Ralph Nader addresses a variety of issues, ranging from the morality and legitimacy of the invasion of Iraq to climate change to minimum wage increases to the use of covert drone strikes in the Middle East by writing letters to a succession of sitting presidents. These letters to the president either go entirely ignored or generate meaningless responses that suggest to Ralph Nader the president thinks these issues really aren't issues at all. We should also note this year marks the 50th anniversary of Ralph Nader's seminal work Unsafe at Any Speed, which certainly put him on the map as an author and advocate for public safety. Again, the name of the book is Return to Sender, Unanswered Letters to the President, 2001 to 2015. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Ralph Nader back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us, sir.
No, you're welcome, Joe. Thank you.
Very nice to have you here. How much did you expect, I guess, in writing a letter to a president, what do you expect to receive in response?
Well, it's a good word you use, expect. The whole thrust of these letters is to demonstrate to the public that if we write these letters to our elected officials, Congress, state legislatures, president, we're defining our expectations of them. And if we have low expectations of our politicians, they're going to oblige us. But if we have higher expectations, if we send them personal letters that basically say, this is what you should do, this is what you shouldn't do, this is what's going on in the country you may not know about, this is what's going on in your own government you may not know about, you're defining a higher level of expectation. And the beauty of letters is it's the most democratic media around, because when you send a letter to an elected representative, no one's censoring that letter. No one's distorting that letter. Nobody's blacking out that letter. And in that sense, it gives you authorship. It gives you agency, to use the modern term. And it gets you to do other things. Now, when you're stonewalled and you don't get an answer, and you don't even get an acknowledgement of receipt, what are you to do? Well, that's why with these letters, Joe, we sent them around. Like we sent a letter on infectious disease epidemics that the government's not doing enough to prevent to the Centers for Disease Control. Or we'll send it to some citizen groups or some political opponents, maybe, or to the press. So it's not like they're going into a dark hole, but it does reflect on the president. I mean, I wrote two critical letters to Prime Minister Stephen Harper of Canada, and back came a formal acknowledgement of receipt by his chief of correspondence. He said they absorbed the content, and they're referring it to the relevant ministry. Well, at least you know it got there.
Right.
So you have, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who write to the president, and here's where when they get a response. When they invite him to, say, a social function, a graduation, they always send out a regret. And thank you, we regret, can't do it. The other category of response is when it's a high-profile issue like the GM bailout controversy, they have a robo letter. They have a form letter, oftentimes ludicrously off the point to the letter that you sent them. And then the third category is when they want to use letters as political props. Mm. They see a letter from an 11-year-old, hey, we can use this, on the campaign trail or something. But substantive letters in the past used to really have an effect. I mean, there were scientists at MIT who would send letters to the president on nuclear arms control or nuclear explosion moratoriums, and it would really have an effect. It's gotten worse and worse is what I'm saying.
I find it interesting to at least note that I would expect that if I sent a letter, the response would be different if you, Ralph Nader, sent a letter. Obviously, you are high profile. You have run for president of the United States. Does that enter into this, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of saying, you know, as someone said, well, if I can't get a letter answered, how can John Q. or Jane Q. Public? And it doesn't matter. If they don't want to answer a letter, it doesn't matter who sends it. For example, this is one of my favorites. Mark Green and Senator Gary Hart, retired, and former Mayor Dinkins of New York, and about 12 other prominent retired Democrats. I mean, you know, they've been elected to Congress. They've been elected to mayors, et cetera. In mid-2012, they sent a letter to Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, Democrat, and the leader of the Senate, Senator Harry Reid. And they said, you know, you're heading for a rough election, my friends, but you should pay attention to these old-line Democratic reform issues that you're ignoring, you know, starting with restoring the minimum wage and others. And they listed them. Now, can you believe that they never even got an acknowledgement from Pelosi or Reid, never mind a response? So it's getting worse. And one reason it prompted this book, Return to Sender, not only it covers a lot of ground and it's short reading, you can read one letter at a time on something that might interest you, but it defines a repudiation by officialdom, by our elected representatives, of the voice of the people. Now, if I was a major contributor, campaign contributor to the Democrats or President Obama, you know, I'd get an answer. There's no doubt about it. Tom Steyer or George Soros, they probably get answers. But I don't expect the president to answer all these letters. I mean, he has a staff in the White House. They have a large number of volunteers who go to the White House every day. It's a long historic tradition. And they receive the letters and they categorize them as volunteers. He also, of course, could refer the letters to departments and agencies, the Auto Safety Agency or the Department of Defense. But he didn't either. In fact, I wrote George W. Bush and Barack Obama once, and I said, what is your policy on responding to correspondence? No answer.
So you've been at this for a long time. As I mentioned, Unsafe at Any Speed is celebrating its 50th anniversary. So prior to 2001, were you receiving letters back from presidents and other political leaders?
I didn't write as many. The answer is sporadic. Once in a while, President Carter would respond. President Reagan would never respond. President Nixon, I got invited to the wedding of Julie Nixon at the White House, and I stood in line. I guess that's one response. But by and large, they don't. It's a pain to respond. I mean, you ask them questions about policies, and they don't want to explain their policies. They don't want to tell you especially what they don't want to do. And that's true for a lot of senators and representatives. You take someone like Ed Markey, who I've been supportive of since 1976 when he was elected from Massachusetts. And he doesn't respond to my letters. Bernie Sanders, I've called him for 15 years and sent him letters. He doesn't respond to my letters. And we're on the same side, so to speak. So this is a decay of the culture, of the literary culture, the civic culture. It's really interesting in the sense that it's never been easier to respond. I mean, they don't have to put a stamp on. They have the franking privilege in Congress and the White House. By the way, in Canada, the citizens have the franking privilege along with members of Parliament. So they can write their member of Parliament without a stamp.
What do you believe the alternative course is to then have your voice heard on these issues? If the letters you're writing aren't being read or answered or responded to, what's the backup?
Well, I don't know if they're not being read. We have a way of making sure they get there because we sent it by post, we sent it by email, and by fax. But they've gotten rid of the fax a few months ago in the White House. No, I think they are being read. They're just not being replied to. And the utility of the letters is that it can get your dander up. I mean, it can get you to do more civically and politically. If you take it impersonally, if you take it personally, you swallow it in your ego. But if you take it impersonally as a phenomenon of the political system rejecting the civic culture, you tend to be motivated, at least I do, to do more. And when you do send it around, to get President Obama's opinion, I wrote him a letter once authored by a particularly virulent E. coli that was in a petri dish in Austria that caused a number of deaths and contaminated food. And the E. coli basically wrote to President Obama and said, look, you know, I'm about to expire and I want to redeem myself. And you want to talk about terrorism, the real terrorism are viruses and bacteria. And you better start putting more resources into it. Well, I sent it to the Centers for Disease Control scientists, and they let's put it this way, they got a little morale left as well as a chuckle out of it.
When you, but back to the point of what you do as a, as another recourse then, even if they're being read and you're not being responded to, then how do you get your voice heard, do you think?
All right, well, I'm putting a call in to Senator Ed Markey. Okay. He just doesn't want to call back. Once in a while, his staff will call back and say, what do you want? I tell him, I want to meet with Ed Markey, you know, back to 1976, you know. What's going on here? He's supposed to be a progressive senator. How am I going to answer your question on that? Well, in about a week, I'm going to be at the Roe Center in Roe, Massachusetts, on a sort of a civic skill seminar, how to turn knowledge into successful action. I'm going to take the people there and use this as an example. How do you get a senator and representative to come to a town meeting where you, the citizenry, are summoning them? They're not having the town meeting. You're saying, dear Senator Markey, the people in Massachusetts are pretty powerless when it comes to Congress. We have a whole agenda how to empower people as workers, taxpayers, consumers, communities, et cetera. We're going to deliver 200 to 300 people in X town in Massachusetts, and at your convenience, we want you there. Now, we're actually going to do that. Now, that can be done by anybody. Anybody who has some sort of civic circle, friends, neighbors, you know, co-workers, can develop a practice where they create the town meeting, and that means face-to-face with their legislature, which is not easy to do. But so few people turn out, Joe, to these town meetings that are called by representatives and senators, that if you can say in the town hall or in the high school auditorium in X town or city, we're going to deliver 250 to 300 people, they are not going to say no to you. And then you got them in a room. And there's no 140-character tweet. You got them in the room. And it can be videotaped, and the press can be there. Now, who can stop people from doing that? I mean, people make so many excuses for themselves about their powerlessness, and you can't fight City Hall, and what good will it do? I mean, you've probably heard it 1,000 times on your program. You know,
right.
the communication of despair, ridiculous. If you can't do it in the U.S., where are you going to do it? If you can't do it in town meeting New England, where are you going to do it?
Do you feel as optimistic of getting your voice across as you did in 1965 with Unsafe at Any Speed?
I don't feel. Optimism to me is a given. So I'm always optimistic because pessimism has no function. I decided to learn that back in undergraduate days. It's just an indulgence of intellectual vanity. So you always have to hope for the best. But realistically, you're right. It's much harder now. We used to get on the television network news with really newsworthy reports. In the last 15, 20, 25 years, we've had really newsworthy reports. But the nature of news has changed, as you know. Look at the New York Times Magazine. It used to be a very serious magazine with maybe 15 major articles. I mean, look at the razzle-dazzle now. You can hardly figure out what kind of layout it is, much less, you know, the strategy behind this kind of pop culture that's gotten into the most serious newspaper, Sunday magazine in America. And so we're all trying to grapple with it. Local public radio is very good. NPR National has real problems. For example, I get on local public radio. I've been a supporter of public radio before it was created. I don't expect special treatment, but I have never been on Terry Gross. I haven't been on Diane Reams since 2004. I haven't been on Charlie Rose since 2004. Ashbrook, not since 2004. And they're supposed to be serious programs. Well, they have a lot of right-wing people on because the right wing beats up on them. They beat up on them in Congress and everywhere. Our side, you know, says, oh, this is great, PBS, NPR. And why should we want to beat up on them? Well, by the result of that is they marginalize us.
Do you think your reputation was hurt at all after the presidential run in 2000?
Among the liberal intelligentsia, yes. Because basically, they're caught up in this least worst politics, even though they don't like the Democratic candidates necessarily. They're better than the Republican candidates. Therefore, how dare anybody challenge them? And they need a civics lesson because, you know, if you ask Gore, how did he lose the election? The first thing he would say is, I won the popular vote, but the Electoral College took it away from me, put it into Florida, where it was stolen in a whole variety of ways and endorsed by a political 5-4 decision in the Supreme Court, which stopped the Florida Supreme Court's order to have a full Florida state recount. So he doesn't blame the Green Party, but there are a lot of liberal intelligentsia types who are looking for an alibi. And I resent that a great deal, because if we all have an equal right to run for elective office, then we're all trying to get votes from one another. And then we're all either trying to get votes from one another and we're spoilers of one another, or none of us are spoilers. I mean, why should a third party candidate be a second class citizen? I mean, when Matt Funicello ran on the Green Party for Congress in your area of north of Albany,
yeah.
He wasn't treated as a third class citizen. He got on the debates. That's the way it should be with the Republican and Democratic candidates. And he contributed a great deal to the debate. I happen to be a great fan of Matt. I've called him democracy's baker. He's a baker.
Yes, he is.
And a very active citizen. So we really have to raise our expectation levels. You know, when you have low expectation levels for your children, guess what? They meet them. And same in politics. You've got to start demanding more and basically say, you work for us, and you should never forget that.
Ralph Nader will be giving quite the civics lesson on Friday, the 15th of May at the Roe Camp and Conference Center in Roe, Massachusetts. You can find out more by going to their website, which is roecenter.org. Again, it's Friday, May 15th. Getting it done, how to restore and repair our wounded democracy, roecenter.org. Also, the new book is Return to Sender, Unanswered Letters to the President, 2001 to 2015. The book is published by Seven Stories. Ralph Nader, it's always a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing with us.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you, your listeners in the Albany area.
Great. Thank you very much. Again, Ralph Nader's book, Return to Sender, Unanswered Letters to the President, 2001 to 2015. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.